undeserved sweetness, Sir Ben Okri OBE. After the wind lifts the beggar from his bed of trash and blows to the empty pubs at the road's end, there exists only the silence of the world before dawn and the solitude of trees. Handel on the set mysteriously recalls to me the long hot nights of childhood spent in malarial slums in the midst of potent shrines at the edge of great seas. Dreams of the past sing with great voices of the future. And now the world is assaulted with a sweetness it doesn't deserve. Flowers sing with the voices of absent bees. The air swells with the vibrant solitude of trees who nightly whisper of reinvading the world. But the night bends the trees into my dreams, and the stars fall with their fruits into my lonely, world-burnt hands. Thank you very much for coming on, Sir Ben Okri, OBE. We're very excited to have you here.
Real pleasure to be here.
So,
why did you choose that poem?
I think we wanted to pick a poem which very much gave an indication of sort of your style without leaning into any one particular theme that you might have had. So something that's more overtly political, for example, or something which leans into, for example, your later work to do with climate and so on and so forth. And to be entirely honest, the last line, world burnt hands, just has a particular appeal to me, the way it sounds. And it ends right there. It's very concrete.
I think it was also we're just kind of analyzing it a little bit before looking at the punctuation. Really like how you use the punctuation in that poem especially, and also a specific word that you use. I think it was invade was one of the words there. I think there's an interesting feeling of almost pantheism to some of your writing as well. I don't know, what was kind of going through your head when you write a poem like that?
Well, I mean, I wrote that poem when I was kind of almost roughly your age, which is why I was interested in why you chose it. Mm. It's a really early poem. I'd just gone through my first period of homelessness in London. That's why that whole thing about when the wind blows the beggar. Mm-hmm. So it's me looking at London. Mm-hmm. So it's a poem. It's a poem partly of homelessness, partly a meditation about the world, a meditation on what's happening to trees, what's happening to nature. It's a meditation about loneliness. It's about suffering. Mm-hmm. It's about hope. It's about courage. It's about being young and yet still being unafraid. So it's many, many, many things. And so I was just interested in the resonance of your choice. Mm-hmm. They didn't choose a much later one. They chose one that is, for me, still saturated in a lot of hope and suffering. The Civil War is not that far behind. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been that long away from Nigeria. I'd written my first novel. My second novel was just about to come out. Mm-hmm. So it was a very key period in my early life. Mm-hmm. I'd written all these poems. Many of them were political poems, some were love poems, and many of them were just poems of solitude. And it was written in a very, very direct style. I was trying to change my style from a very elaborate, mm-hmm. Fruity sort of style that I had at the beginning. And I was simplifying, I was shedding.
Why shedding that?
Because it was true. Because if you'd been in the streets, if you'd known a bit of homelessness, you don't get flowery anymore. You want to tell, you want to tell truth directly. Because if you've been in the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning and it's winter and you don't have an overcoat, there's no floweriness about that. There's something about knowing the world from that point of view that like it strips the pretense from your language and it makes you concentrate. So it changed my style.
I felt that a lot with the lack of punctuation sort of throughout gives it that kind of density in the flow. You're almost getting blown by the wind in the poem. I'm not going to take the analysis too far, but I did very much feel sort of like you're running through the experiences in that early poem. So I suppose my question is, how has that changed to the current period in terms of your approach to poetry, and what has changed and what has stayed the same in your writing?
Oh my goodness, what a question.
There's a lot to unpack there, so feel free to just pick something or another.
But I'm always changing. If you from this part of our conversation so far, you noticed that I stress the impact of experience on aesthetics. When I began to write, it was aesthetics first over experience. So the style dominated what I was trying to say, because the people I learned from were all great stylists. But as I went through the strange experience of my life, I kind of let my experience shape my style. So it turned the other way around. I became more interested in how true language can be in relation to experience while still being rich. The richness is because I have a fundamentally poetic attitude to life. I feel that life is essentially multidimensional and simultaneous. And anything that's multidimensional and simultaneous, you need an incredible richness to convey it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to get away from that. I'm trying to get to the truth of things. So you need richness plus simplicity. It's a tremendous combination. And then I also became very fascinated by how to convey reality, which is, I think, maybe one of the biggest themes in my writing life and in my personal life. How do you convey reality? Which leads to the question, what is reality? Do we actually know what it is? How do we analyze it? How do we encounter it? How do we embrace it? How do we transform it? The transformation has got to do with the political dimension. How do we analyze it has got to do with the aesthetic dimension. So all of these have been very key facets of my... So each new book I bring out is a new aesthetics, because I'm still trying to answer that fundamental question. How the hell do you convey this strange, mysterious, unfathomable thing that we call reality? How do you do it? Without becoming overly philosophical, remember that it still has to be literature, which means it still has to be a direct dialogue with experience.
And that's very interesting, because you mentioned the sort of aesthetics first attitude you had before. In that, I hear kind of what you could call like a Wildean approach to aesthetics. So for our listeners, Oscar Wilde, who wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, essentially was an advocate of this view called aestheticism, which was the view that art is good because art is good. It serves no purpose in itself. It has aesthetic value only through formal features and so on and so forth. And you seem now to be quite strongly opposed to that view. Literature is, even if not in a philosophical way, in some way a mediator to truth, and truth very much matters to fiction.
No, I think once you've been affected by the spirit of aesthetics, it never leaves you. So I'm not opposed to it. If anything, I'm more engaged with it. It's just that I'm trying to,
as a medium to,
yeah, I'm trying to remove the mask and the jewel, the encrustations, because aestheticism taken too far becomes encrustations. It becomes masks. It becomes layers. It becomes things attached to, things on top of.
How do you kind of define it, like aesthetics? I mean, even for people listening who may think of aesthetics as, is it something visual about it? Is it something more to do with feeling and experiencing a work? How does one define like the aesthetics of writing, just so that we can break it down a little bit more?
I think the aesthetics of writing really is an attitude to writing where the beauty of the thing is perhaps more important than, I have to be very, very careful here. Let's leave it there. Let's just say that the beauty, the style, the way in which it is expressed, the way in which it is revealed, shown, is the most important thing. That's an aesthetic.
And is that subjective in terms of
beauty? Yeah, it's very subjective, and it's got to do with a sense of style. It's got to do with a sense of richness of language. It's got to do with a sense of complexity. And I'm thinking of many people here. I'm thinking of Henry James on the one hand, Oscar Wilde you mentioned, James Joyce, Proust, Flaubert. These are all writers for whom the style, the beauty, the sensibility is the most important aspect of the encounter.
Mm.
And then on the other hand, you have leaner, more direct writers, like, here again, I've got to be very careful. Stevenson, in some ways, is an aesthetic writer, but there's a kind of a directness. More the American writers like Pushkin in his prose. For English writers, you have to go back to, I think you have to go back to maybe 17th century writers who, like the Journal of the Plague Year, writing directly about experience where early journalism and literature kind of came together. Orwell is the other side. Do you get what I'm saying? So there's it's sort of very hard and fast.
You have to mediate the relationship such that literature doesn't become philosophy or theory and yet retains that essential connection to that which is important. I actually studied Flaubert at university, and you know, one of the big themes in the secondary literature and the thought about Flaubert is mediating your life through that literature. You said everyday life is poetic. So when you have a narrative, for example, in a story, you bring that narrative into your way of perceiving, or when there's...
Well, you bring your perceiving into the narrative.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah.
So it's a two-way relationship.
Yeah, there's also that. Absolutely.
There's that relationship between reader... could you maybe expand on that a little bit, the relationship as well between reader, writer, and the work itself?
That's a very complex relationship. That because the reader comes to a work that's already finished.
Yeah.
Which the reader comes to the end of a process. But the reader comes to the end of a process that in itself is a very complex one, in which there's been a lot of abandonment, a lot of stuff has been abandoned, lost, shedded, cut out, removed, compressed. But it's all there in this thing that you experience. So you're experiencing the whole process, but not in a linear way. Because I personally believe that a work of art contains all of its visions and all of its revisions, all of its scaffolding, everything that it had to lose in order to get there. It's all there, even though you don't see it. If the work is any good, it contains even the road that it didn't take. It's all in that work.
For the reader as well as the writer?
It's there for the reader, but the reader doesn't know it.
Mm.
Because it's all been distilled. It's all been settled into this work.
Yeah, I saw the video that you did for the Booker Prize. Looking back, you did the video more recently. Of course, you won the prize in 1991. I remember seeing your workbooks, essentially, your notebooks, which you wrote a portion of the novel in. And you had one side would be nearly empty or basically empty, and those revisions would be on the side. And I think that's quite a good image, that this sort of empty or not entirely empty side is kind of getting carried over into the work. And that's also you getting carried into the work.
It's a physical aspect of writing as well, to some extent.
Oh, yeah, but that's changed tremendously. I don't work like that anymore.
Yeah. Is it a typewriter, computer?
No, I handwrite. I still
handwrite.
Still. Still handwrite. And then type and then handwrite. You were asking about the relationship between the work, the reader, and the writer. I have to stress that what the writer writes is never what the reader reads. The reader does not read the book that the writer has finished writing. It's not the same book. A shadow falls between them. A book is changed from manuscript into the form of a book with the covers, print, type. A book is changed so that by the time you actually approach the book, the mediation that you talk about is already taking place tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Even the type in which the book is set affects the experience of the book. So when I say the book that the writer writes is not the book that the reader reads, I am being very philosophical as well. And also trying to account for the gap in which genuine creativity, the creativity of reading, which is the most important creativity, takes place.
And so what do you think a reader can understand about you, not just as an author, but also as a human being, when they're reading your work? You talk of a shadow passing between, and yet the readerly experience, even when it's creative, is to experience somebody writing, a voice, right?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I write for the reader to experience me. I write for the reader to experience themselves. The whole art of my writing is designed exactly for that. I'm not an important part of the process. I'm creating a mirror. Shakespeare referred to the play as a mirror, and I feel that very strongly. We don't know anything about Shakespeare from reading King Lear or from reading Hamlet. You can't deduce very much. So you can't tell how many pints of beer he drank a day. You can't tell whether it was a loudmouth, bad tempered, you know, foul kind of person, or whether it was generous and loved animals. You can't tell anything about Shakespeare from Hamlet. You can't even really guess at his sensibility. You can't guess very much. That's because a genuine work of art creates a mirror. And you look into this mirror and you think you're seeing all of these characters, but actually what you're seeing are characters that you, the reader, are creating. You're generating that world with these little signs that we've given you, that we've arranged in a certain way. You're generating all the emotions, you're generating the imagery, you're generating the feel, the dynamism, the twist and turns of the plot, all of that has been generated by you, the reader. What you get out of it, what you glimpse of the human spirit, of the human condition from it, you're glimpsing out of your own experience, your own intelligence and your own imagination, your own capacity for encounter with the mysteries and the truth of life. So it's you, finally. If a book is great to you, it's because your mind and your spirit are great in the encounter with the book. That's why so many of us can love, to very great degrees, very different kinds of books, great books as well as terrible books. I know people who had a great tragic emotion from really badly written, you know, and I used to be amazed by this. I used to think, how can that be? And then over the years, I've come to understand that, oh, it's not the book. It's the richness that the person is bringing to it, that the book somehow captured directly or indirectly by choice or by accident. Books are very strange things. Literature is one of the most mysterious things for that reason.
Now, that's very true. The point about, I suppose, the construction on the part of the reader, even at the most basic level, you're constructing what the character looks like to you. The affectations, where exactly the narrative voice is, how you feel about each character, and so on. I find then that I have a bit of a ambivalent relationship with movie adaptations. I'm just curious to see what you think about often movie adaptations of works. Do you feel that they take that imagination away to some extent, or take away that creation?
Oh,
or?
Absolutely, absolutely. They don't. It shouldn't even be called an adaptation. We should call it another work altogether. No movie of The Great Gatsby I've seen resembles The Great Gatsby that I've read.
Yeah.
It just does.
It's my biggest frustration on the cover of a book is when you have the photo from the famous movie on the front of the book, and it robs that from you a little bit, right?
Yeah. And also, you see, the thing about the cinema, I think the cinema is most powerful when it's doing its own imagining, when it's doing its own dreaming, when it's making up its own world. What it has to work with a work and then make a world out of that. I mean, I can't say that in absolute terms, because I love movies like The Godfather. They're movies I love that are based on very good books. But very few movies have been successful that have been based on really great books. I've never seen a really great movie on Hamlet, in spite of Laurence Olivier's great effort. I think a really great work of literature can't be translated to the screen.
Speaking of these different movies, and different mediums rather, so movie and book, how do you think, is there a difference between someone experiencing a movie versus someone experiencing a book? Or is that just art being art, whether that's a painting, a book, a movie, a play? You know, you're a playwright, a humorist, a poet, a novelist. So how do these all kind of compare to each other?
Well, with the film, the imagination of the director embodied by particular actors, completely mediate your experience. You don't, when you're watching a film, you don't actually have to imagine what the main character looks like. You don't actually have to do much imagining. You just have to open your eyes and look. When you're reading a novel, your imagination from the beginning, if it's a good novel, is ignited. And then you become the director. You become the director. You become the actor. You supply all that. You become the casting director. You do all of that work. You do all of the editing work. You do everything, and you do it at tremendous speed. You're doing it at the speed of your reading. Yeah? With a movie, even the pace of the experience is determined for you. If it's a heist, the time in which the heist is going to take place has already been shaped for you. It's going to take 15 minutes. They're going to go there. They're going to go there. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. There's nothing you can do to alter the pace except maybe be drunk or be drugged this way. Then maybe you can have another mediating quality over what you're experiencing. So film comes to you complete. What it allows you to imagine, it allows you to imagine after the experience. So the power of film is afterwards. Mm. So it affects you powerfully at the time, but then you go away and then resonances, residual images, moments come back to you afterwards and haunts you if it's a really great film. And then you elaborate on it, and then you begin to expand and ask deep questions about human life and people and motivation and so on and so forth. Whereas the novel in front of you, or the poem even more complicatedly so, with the poem you have to do a more elaborate act of furnishing, a more profound creation of a world. You have to extrapolate, but by direct intelligence, the themes, the meanings, the hints from the work. So I think the greater the work of art, the deeper the intelligence it requires from you, both at the time of the experience and long afterwards for the rest of your life.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that you mention actors as mediating our experience of a movie. I find the idea of different levels of mediation really interesting. The director's mediation, or the director wants, let's say, a viewer to look at, is also slightly different to what happens with a book. Again, like you say, it's placed in front of us, and that visual experience is directly there. Katharine Hepburn, you know, was seen for her physicality, and she was chosen for particular movies because of that physicality. You know, in the Philadelphia Story, the script was written around
her
family. Around yeah. her yeah. way of speaking, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think, again, there are these differences between mediums. For you, is it something that you prefer, let's say, working on a play or working on a novel or a poem, or is it just different experience itself?
It depends on what I want. It depends on what kind of mirror I want to create, and the way I most want you to affect yourself, because that's all I'm really doing. The plays are an extraordinary medium to work with. Because again, you actually have the physical characters exactly. right there in front of you.
Yep.
But what they say on that stage, and the way in which the space, the actual physical space, the air, the atmosphere, the way that alchemizes the words that they're saying is incredible. It is unbelievable. That's a factor you don't have with film. Film does not allow for the space between the screen and the person. The space is not part of how it's built.
Mm.
Maybe it's built for a cinema screen, but possibly with television, or even your phone now in mind. But the stage assumes that there's going to be air between you and the actors. Mm. That makes a big difference. It's the only medium apart from music where that is an immeasurable factor in how the work of art gets to you.
It makes me think of Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot. I studied Beckett at university, and so the first time I interacted with the play was as a text. classic sort of, you know, last minute university work. And I felt I didn't quite get it. You know, for our listeners, essentially this these two abstract characters waiting for somebody, Godot, and it's quite difficult to work out exactly who they are, what their beliefs are, and so on. And there's a lot of confusion and so on and so forth. And when I watched the play, it was like it instantly clicked for me, because you have these embodied people, which are irreducibly human. And then there's that text, which is slightly incoherent, but now you ascribe things to. And so that creative adding on from the point of the audience is very, very present there. And I think that's a particular demonstration of how theatre might be different from literature as well.
Yeah, but theatres, the playwright is writing half of an artistic experience. It took me a long time to realize that. They're not writing the whole play. They're writing half of it, which exists on the other side of the mirror. And then the director comes along and pulls that half out into reality. And then actors, stage sets, lighting. And then you realize, oh, the play that the playwright wrote is just really indications. It's almost like poetry. Really. The stage directions, I mean, there's a famous stage direction, Peter Schaffer, where he said, I think they crossed one of the famous mountains in South America. That's all it said. They crossed so-and-so mountain. That was it. What are you supposed to do as a director with that? Right? I suppose give the image of mountains one side of the stage. You have to do something with it. But that's just an indication given to you. In Shakespeare, many, many times, very, very bare stage direction, out of which the director has to pull it out from the mirror, build a world with it. So the playwright writes with half of the experience given to you, and the other half is a gift of improvisation and a gift of imagination to the director. It's saying, I'm trusting you. I'm trusting you to make of this a world that reveals what it is that I'm trying to say that you will experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the playwright is much more trusting, even more trusting than the novelist, because we novelists, when I'm being a novelist, we indicate the world. I wouldn't say they cross us, I'll describe it in great detail because I want you to see it. I want you to feel it. So the different media, the poetry is the same thing. The poetry also trusts your imagination. In that poem you read, I didn't describe the landscape in which it took place. I let you do that. I'm trusting you to do that.
Thanks for the trust.
you're trusting Ollie to read it as well. You're trusting the reader to take it and interpret it in their own way. And it's also vulnerable, I suppose, for maybe the poet who's then very removed. But I don't know how you feel once that work is out there. Do you still feel some sort of attachment to it? Do you still want, do you care how people interpret that work, or is it up to them, kind of death of the author?
Well, I think you train yourself to have a relationship with death as a writer. By that I mean, every work has to die and then be resurrected in the world. You write so the work dies with you, and then you pass it on, then it's resurrected in the world. That's why I keep saying, the work that you wrote and the work that people read is not the same work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really important philosophical point I'm making.
Mm. Yeah, the danger of, I don't want to call it misinterpretation because I wouldn't be so strict, but the danger of a work being interpreted in a way that you're not comfortable with is always there, that kind of vulnerability. And one example, just to relate it to your work now, which I can think of where that's happened, is the ascription of what's called magical realism to you. So for our listeners, magical realism, very shortly, although it kind of evades definition,
is the statement of the magical, the supernatural, and so on and so forth in these matter-of-fact, simple ways, as if it makes up part of the work. I wanted to ask you about, throughout your work, how it interacts with magical realism and why you don't feel comfortable with that descriptor as something which pins your work down and doesn't quite capture it.
Yeah, because it's not just magical stuff I'm doing. I'm also doing spiritual stuff. I'm doing mythical stuff. I'm doing mystical stuff. I'm doing poetic stuff. I'm doing lyrical stuff. I'm doing indirect stuff. I'm doing work in which absence is the most important thing. So it's so, the range of my books is so vast. I mean, I've been writing now for 40 years. So to put my work under one label is, I think, a laziness. And it's also to deprive readers of actually experiencing the work for themselves. There's something about labels. You assume something is going to be a certain way before you experience it. And I think we cheat the reader of their own surprise, their own alchemy.
We usually ask all our guests a pretty simple question, and it can be surprisingly elucidating. Just when was the last time you changed your mind, and in a very significant way?
I change my mind all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm writing an essay right now in which I've had to change my mind three times in the course of 2 days. I thought it was one kind of essay, realized that it wasn't. I had to rewrite the whole thing from the inside completely. And I had to do it again today before I came to meet you. Mm-hmm. That's because one is always constantly discovering the direct relationship between what it is I'm trying to do and the reality that is impossible to capture. It changes even as you're capturing it. It's very quantum mechanics. I find a great sympathy with that understanding of the elusiveness of reality and how it is fixed by your fixation. It is fixed by your attention. It is fixed by your state of mind, whatever that state of mind is at that particular time. Aesthetically, my latest book, latest novel, Madame So Sorceress, a completely different style from anything I've written before. That, I keep saying to people, with every new book I write, I actually have to break my hands and start again, grow new hands.
Mm-hmm. Change your mind artistically in that sense as well.
Yeah, but also my hands, because the hands is the means by which one's aesthetic works its way through.
Is that physicality maybe that we were talking about earlier, the handwriting?
Absolutely.
The laboring. I think Seamus Heaney writes about the labor of writing, and
about digging.
He digs in the same way that his father dug, but he digs with his pen.
Yes.
I'll dig with it, he writes at the end of that poem.
Yes, I've been looking for his handwriting to see signs of digging.
Yeah, must be pretty bad handwriting with a shovel. But so you mentioned there's always a fixation or an attention which an artist or a writer is giving. That will be very different now to the beginning of your career.
Well, look at look at Cézanne. Who I'm very fascinated by, for the same reason. He was wrestling, constantly wrestling. And in one day you can see him changing his mind about an apple, about how an apple looks. From one sketch to another, he looks at it and he realizes, oh my goodness, that shadow is not a shadow. My goodness, that shadow is a void. And that void has layers of, and each attempt to capture it is anguish, because each time he sees one thing, but when he goes back, looks again, it's gone, it's changed, it's altered. That's how amazing it is.
That's the bringing of art into life, or the bringing of poetical into life. And many people don't engage with art in this way. Many people, or maybe aren't cognizant of the fact that their ways of seeing are mediated by whatever media or art form it may be. What would you say to somebody to help them bring the poetical into their life, into their way of seeing things around them, whether it be an apple or anything else?
Oh, it's very simple. I'd say pay attention. pay attention. We don't. We live in a time when where it's so distracted. We don't listen long enough. We don't look long enough. We don't listen long enough. We're not still long enough. You know, we give this idea of writing as being somehow separated from the spirit, but it's not. You can only write what you are. You want to write better, you actually have to be a richer human being. It's not just enough to keep writing and hoping that your writing style will improve with the 10,000 drafts that you're doing. That's one way of doing it, but it's very laborious. I keep saying it's laborious. You want to transform your writing? Transform yourself. You've got to transform your spirit. You have to transform your relationship with the world. You have to have a profoundly vital engagement with the world. How can we talk about climate or the politics or what's going on in the world when we're not paying attention to it, we're not listening to it? How can we begin to form any kind of judgment of what our politicians are saying when we don't look at them, when we don't listen to them? Listen to their tone. Listen to the tone of their voices. Watch what they do. Watch what kind of human beings are you actually dealing with. We just take policies. They just spout these things. I'm going to do this. But we don't listen to the person. You know, we've lost the art of actually listening to the person out of which these things, because when we do that, we will know whether we can trust this person or not, because you can hear their spirit. You see the trail of their deeds, the trail of their integrity or their lack of it. And the same thing with the work of art. You know, people don't read carefully. In new books I've been writing for the last 15, 20 years, there's a line I have at the beginning of all of my books. It's always written in very small letters, and it goes, read slowly. I say, read slowly, because people are too fast. And being too fast is equated with intelligence, but intelligence has got nothing to do with being fast. Intelligence has got to do with the strength and the solidity and the truth of your understanding and of your distillation. Finally, of your deeds. That's where it's at. It's not in one's head. It's not in how one's mind works. It's in actually what you do, and the things that you do. Do they stand? Do they last? Do they grow in light and luminosity, truth and value from year to year? 10 years later, do you look at this one deed and go, wow, that was and still remains a great deed that keeps growing and giving to humanity, helping us, teaching us, guiding us in justice and truth and fullness? Pay attention. Listen, grow the spirit, grow the character, grow the resilience and the toughness. Look at the world.
Ben, thank you very much for joining us today. Do you have anything to leave our audience with, maybe a final thought? I think there's already a lot there for people to ponder on.
Final thoughts. My final thoughts might go on for a long time, because I've been thinking a long time. My final thoughts are that we're in dangerous and difficult, very troubling times that's going to require the very, very best from those of us who are living now. If we're going to make a kind of a future that we deserve, that our children deserve, we have to raise the game of our spirit in a way that we never have before. I feel for the first time in a long time in human history, we have to earn life. We have to earn civilization. We have to earn the future. We have to earn it. We've been given it up till now. From now on, we have to earn it with our labor, our love, our truth, our courage, our intelligence, life intelligence. We're really, really, these are really shaping times. We're on the very edge of a precipice. and we're being called to, I say it, I'm going to say it very clearly, we're being called to be a new kind of humanity. We're being called to be new people, all of us who are alive today. Otherwise, there just wouldn't be a world for us. So I think that's very beautiful. I think that's very powerful. I think it's deeply humbling. And I want to infect everybody with the courage that it needs and the love that it requires.
That's a beautiful note to end on. So Ben Okri, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
This has been Critical Edge. Thank you so much for listening in. Here we learn how to think, not what to think. We really hope you enjoyed that interview with Sir Ben. We certainly did. Please like and subscribe to listen to more amazing guests and expand your mind. Thank you. We'll see you next time.